All right, well, let's continue on here. Let's make sure you are in fellowship. Rebound if necessary. If not, then good. You stayed in fellowship for an hour and 20 minutes now. And let's pick up here with verse 17. We're dealing with this verse that does seem, granted, on the surface, it looks a little out of place, which, again, to me, argues for the authenticity of the verse that it is here designed to. It kind of shouts out to me that Paul must have put this in here because there's no other reason for it to be here. We're dealing with this issue of not drinking water only, but using a little wine here in a medicinal sense. Point 17, it is readily acknowledged that the drinking water in the ancient world was sometimes impure, as it is in certain parts of the world today, and was a cause of dysentery and other problems. 18, however, it seems unlikely, at least to me it seems unlikely, that Paul was concerned with only with the purity of the drinking water in Ephesus. Otherwise, he would have told Timothy to avoid it altogether. So I think people were smart enough at this time in history, certainly, to know that if water could be purified in a number of fashions, and it's like as it can be today, it can be purified with bleach, it can be purified by boiling, you can do a number of things to water to get rid of impurities. And so I don't think that Paul was thinking that the drinking water was a huge contaminated problem. Otherwise, he would tell him, don't drink water at all. Rather here, point 19, he is instructing Timothy to supplement his normal beverage, which I assume was water, with a small quantity of wine. 20, we do not have to guess as to why Paul was instructing Timothy to do so, since he states directly that it had to do with his stomach. 21, while wine could be used as a safeguard against impure water, it was also very much in keeping with the accepted medicinal use of wine in the ancient world. 22, the Talmud, which is a collection of ancient rabbinic writings consisting of the Mishnah and the Gemara, these constitute the basis for the religious authority in Orthodox Judaism. These are just bits of information for you to be a more knowledgeable believer if you run across these terms, which you might in your studies. Hippocrates, Pliny, and Plutarch all spoke of the value of wine, particularly as it related to provide relief from stomach ailments, which we know was one of Timothy's problems. 23, if we are correct about the fact that Luke may have been an amanuensis, and the more I've studied this book, the more convinced I am that Luke was writing for Paul here. That this was not unusual. Paul often used an amanuensis, and it seems as though it was related to an eye problem that he contracted there on the Damascus Road. We know he was struck blind for 3 days, and that this was direct discipline from God, and that Paul had to sit there, now as an unbeliever, there in those 3 days of darkness, and contemplate why this could have happened. And also, but he knew he had seen the risen Lord. I am Jesus, why are you persecuting me? We assume that he saw him. Well, we have to do more than assume, because he had to be an eyewitness to the resurrection in order to be qualified to be an apostle. And we know that the others heard the voice and saw the blinding light, but apparently Paul was the only one injured by it. So this was directed at him and him alone. As we observe this, it appears that Paul contracted through this, is the consensus, some sort of eye problems that plagued him for the rest of his life. And, of course, they didn't have glasses and contact lens then, so Paul couldn't very well just get around it. We see at the end of the book of Galatians, say, where Paul says, I write this greeting in my own hand, which indicates that it's unusual that he was doing that. The reality is here, when you really get into do a serious work on this book and start comparing vocabulary, there are words that are common only to Luke, Acts, and Hebrews, of course, and it's my contention that Luke wrote Hebrews as well, but that are words that are common only to Luke, Acts, and Timothy. This argues, in my opinion, very strongly for Luke and authorship, or at least he was functioning as an amanuensis, as Paul would have been dictating in this case. So if we're correct about the fact that Luke had been an amanuensis, this medicinal advice, or this medical advice, would also have had the prompting or approval of Dr. Luke. So 24, the Greek term stomachos originally meant the throat and came to be applied to the entire digestive tract, not just the stomach. 25, it is a known fact that a little wine taken with a meal will aid in the digestive process. That's true today. If you drink a little wine with your meal, it aids in the digestion of food because of the natural enzymes found in wine and in grapes in particular. So further, when taken with the meal, there is a far less chance that one will become intoxicated. 26, Timothy had some undefined stomach problem, possibly with his digestion or ulcers. We're not really told what the extent of the problem was, but it was something certainly Paul was cognizant of. And Paul recommends wine as an aid to that problem. 27, apparently Timothy did not enjoy the most robust health, which may have been a direct result of his stomach problems. 28, Paul indicates that Timothy experienced frequent illnesses, which was certainly not the result of divine discipline or sin in his life. Some things, obviously, believers have to be very discerning with regard to this. Some things are definitely discipline. God is just smacking you. And if you're not honest, I've met believers who don't even believe in divine discipline. They've basically opted for the view that everything is just a test. And you never get disciplined by God because God wouldn't discipline us because God loves us. Which is, of course, a direct contradiction to what the book of Hebrews says. It says God disciplines us because he loves us, in fact. Because we are part of his family. So, again, here, this was not the result of that. The term puknos, frequent, means that which occurs frequently or at regular intervals. The noun asthenia first refers to any weakness, limitation, or incapacity. It moves to the idea of illness, sickness, or disease. 29, exactly what the problems were with Timothy's stomach or what the frequent illnesses were is simply not stated. However, point 30, it is clear that Paul believed, likely again in conjunction with the advice of Luke, that wine in small portions would have a salutary, that which promotes health or cures, in fact, effect on Timothy's health. 31, by application, the pastor teacher should do, again, this is an application off of this, not the verses teaching about taking a little wine for a stomach problem, should do what he can legitimately do to take care of his health. Since unattended physical problems may adversely affect his duties in the spiritual realm. And I've noted over the years that when I have not been as regular with the discipline of going to the gym and working out and taking care of myself, that I note a difference when I'm teaching in my wind, in my ability to communicate. I don't notice any, quote, mental difference from that, from not working out, but I notice I'm more physically tired. I seem to need more sleep when I don't work out than when I do, there's nothing wrong at all with taking care of the physical structure that gets you around in this world. And so I would recommend it for all believers, of course, but by application, again, this would be directed towards Timothy, toward the pastor. 32, he should avoid the extreme of an excessive devotion to exercise. I've seen people like that. They worked out 2 hours a day, 7 days a week. You don't need that much. You can get the health benefits from exercise by raising your heart rate for, I believe, no more than 30 minutes is all it takes. And that aids you and all that strengthens the heart. I believe that as you get older, you ought to do a little bit of weight training because your muscles begin to atrophy and they begin to decay. And you don't have to, you know, it's not a deal of, I actually knew a pastor, like, I could bench press 550 pounds. Wow. Well, that doesn't help you teach doctrine. I don't care how much you can bench press. That's not a goal. And I see people that are, you know, weight conscious. How much weight can you lift and all that? No. You can maintain muscle tone with light weights. And it's designed, and that's really all I would recommend is maintaining muscle tone as you get older, as much as you can. So again, he should avoid an extreme of an excessive devotion which would distract him from his study time or the refusal. He should avoid that extreme of using any sense in the physical realm. I think both are extremes to be avoided. The truth lies somewhere in between, as it usually does. 33, the objective is not to have perfect health at all times. Now, for some people, that's their goal in life. I want perfect health at every moment. That's not what God's plan. I see nothing in the Bible that indicates that's what we should strive for. That you are going to be, in fact, as we know, if you aren't sick from time to time and your body does not build up resistance to certain things, the first germ that came along, the first bacteria or virus, would kill you dead or in a doornail. That your body has to have some appropriate resistance to these things. And in some cases, this is heightened by being sick. This is not a benefit of being sick. But, well, it is a benefit of being sick. I mean, I don't counsel anybody try to get sick. And I don't think anybody in their right mind would do that. But when you are sick, okay, well, just accept that this is a part of life in the devil's world. Otherwise, again, the first thing would kill you. So the objective is not to have perfect health at all times. The objective is to do what is appropriate so that he can maximize his time and energies to teach and shepherd his portion of the flock of God. And that requires, again, time, energy, prayer that goes into all of that. And one has to be the better you can handle all that, the stress of it all. Then again, the stress is largely unseen. The sleepless nights, the prayers, the endless prayers for believers, that they'll make it spiritually, that they'll excel at the Bema seat, that they'll maximize in terms of phase three, that they won't become spiritual casualties. This is, you know, my Lupe list is more than long enough, trust me. It's longer than the number of people that I know in some way that are still positive. So that's what, you know, that takes time and energy. And it wears on you at a certain level. So, again, try to use, I would say, good judgment. Pray about it. Don't assume you know everything. And ask God to bless you. Now, the next verse is verse 24 here. The sins of some men are quite evident. Well, the sins are even more so. The sins of some men are quite evident. It leads off, actually, with the indefinite pronoun tis to heighten the fact that he's talking about a specific category. This is not everybody. This is a certain group. That word means that, exactly. Some men or certain men. And then the genitive of anthropos. A-N-T-H-R-O-P-O-S. Again, our word anthropology, the study of man, comes from this word. Of some men, the sins. Hey, hamartia. In the plural. And here, we're dealing with personal sins. Hamartia means to fall short. Literally, to miss the mark. That's the root meaning of it. That, as it were, it's used in shooting a bow and an arrow, that you aim at a target. When you miss the mark, it was called hamartia. The sins of some men, and then you have here this adjective, the nominative feminine plural, to match up with sins, prodelos. P-R-O-D-E-L-O-S. Three times this word's used, it pertains to that which is obvious, manifest, evident, clear, or well known. Of some men, the sins obvious are, is the Greek word order. For smoother English, we translate it the way the New American Standard did. Going before them to judgment. Pro ago here is the verb, and it means exactly that. Ago means to go or lead. Pro means before in terms of spatial orientation, not in terms of time. So in transitive, when it's used intransitively, it means to go before. Spatially, it's used, in an idea of leading somebody to something, with ice, which we will have later in this, the directional preposition, to denote the destination where one's going. And in this case, the sins are going before this guy to judgment. And you got the preposition ice there with this term krisis. K-R-I-S-I-S. Now, this is the process of judging, and that's what krisis means. Krima is a judgment. A krino is to judge. This can also be used as the result of a judgment. Now, the question becomes here, exegetically, who's the judge and what's he judging? And the answer is, it's Timothy and the ordaining council are the judges. Assuming he had other men with him involved in this, which I assume he did. Paul talks about the ordaining council of Timothy's, and he talked about the ordaining council, implying that there was more than one person. And since Timothy was not a frontline apostle, did not have the authority Paul had, I would assume that the idea here is that he would have had a group of men who would have been responsible to help him administrate this. And the idea is the judgment that they're going to render on a potential pastor candidate. And for some pastor candidates, guess what? They're already well known. They are known for what they are. So here it's used with a destination. For instance, say it's used that way in Mark 6:45. Here you see it used very much, you know, not in a metaphorical sense, in a physical sense, in verse 45. And immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him, that's proago, into or to, directional preposition eis, to the other side of the Bethsaida. And so there you see him physically sending them from one place to another. The idea here is that his sins show up before he does. Some the sins of some men are quite evident. Going before them, and this might even be translated as a causal participle here, because they go before them to judgment. They show up, as it were, and so their sins are evident. For others, you got the mild adversative duh here, which is not translated. They actually just translate it as a semicolon. Now, other men, or certain other men. You got the indefinite tis again. Their sins follow after. Again, you've got a chi in here. They actually didn't translate the chi or the duh in this case. Now, or but, as a contrast, other men also follow after. Again, the term here, hamartia, is not repeated, but it is implied in this. Then you have ep akolutheo. E-P-A-K-O-L-O-U-T-H-E-O. It's a compound from akolutheo, which means to follow, and then epi, to follow upon, and the idea is they follow closely. Their sins follow after them. So how is the ordaining council to know? Well, this implies all kinds of discernment. This implies investigation. That they've got to look into these guys, as has been appropriately done. So in certain cases, it hasn't been. Likewise, point to verse 25 now. You have this adverb hosautos, H-O-S-A-U-T-O-S. This is a marker that approximates identity in the same way, or likewise in a similar fashion. In a similar fashion also. Again, now this time they translated the chi adjunctive. Go figure. Sometimes they decide not to, and sometimes they do. Likewise, the works or deeds, ergon. E-R-G-O-N. And works or deeds, ergon comes from the idea, our word ergonomic, of course, comes from this. But the idea is that which one busies himself with, that which he does, that which he works at. That which can be overtly seen about him because of his work. The deeds, the good ones. Here you have a little bit of a Hebraism in the Greek, where they follow the articular noun with the articular adjective. Definite article with kalos. Good or beneficial. Now, we're not talking about the moral nature of his works or his deeds. We're talking about what he does. Is he helpful? Is he beneficial? Does he live a noble life? Likewise, the deeds that are good are quite evident. Again, pro delos, once again, same as above, evident, obvious, manifest, and chi connective here, and those which are otherwise. Literally, those having otherwise, it deals with the persons in view. The deeds have otherwise, or they have a bit of a different quality about them. So likewise, also, deeds that are good, guess what? People are going to find out about it. At a certain level, you can't hide what you are. This is one of the big mistakes believers make. They attempt to fly false colors. They attempt to hide what they are. You can't hide what you are. What you are will be shown up. At the Bema Seat, it's going to be shown in a maximum way. There will be no hiding at the Bema Seat. There will be no excuses at the Bema Seat. There will be no blame at the Bema Seat. You will stand there all by yourself, all by your lonesome. You won't be able to say, I would have been a better believer, but my husband, but my wife, but my kids, but my parents, but my pastor, but my deacons, but. Guess what? The dot won't fly. You're going to ultimately be what you are, and you're going to be seen for what you are. And ultimately, hopefully, if we all do this right, which is what we're shooting for, I hope, we all get great rewards at that point, that you're not going to be shown up as somebody who was a flop in phase two, that you're going to be shown up as a believer that really tried to do it right. That's the goal. So likewise, deeds also that are good are quite evident. Those having otherwise, in other words, those having a different kind of quality from being evident. Okay, so they're not evident. Some people apply, as we're going to see, at a very quiet level. They do things that people don't observe. They might be They might apply at a very high level in the financial realm, and because that's one of the private parts gifts, we don't make any big issue out of it, who does what, and we never will. They might apply quietly, you know, in some area that's out of the way in the local church. As we have announced, I did remember the last announcement. We're redoing the schedule for next year for the setup and tear down of class. If you want to apply in that area, you need to get with Bill, because he's going to be passing out that schedule, I assume, next week, I guess, because we'll be into January. If you want to apply in that area, that's a place you can plug in and apply. How hard is it to set up here and show up and set up tables? Not very hard. No, they're not very heavy. That's why we bought the light ones. We thought ahead. Kidneys. But people that apply maybe in ways you don't see, that they do things for maybe believers that you're not aware of. But those believers know about it. They see applications that are made in their behalf, and they're appreciative. Well, as the ordaining council starts looking into these guys, you're going to have, as we're going to see here, four different kinds of potential pastor candidates. And this gets into which one would you put in the ministry and all that. So, again here, the ones having otherwise, the deeds, it's a nominative, neuter, plural. That's how I know he's talking about the deeds and not the man. Man is a masculine in the Greek. Neuter here is the word ergon. The deeds having otherwise is allos. A-L-L-O-S, that which is different in manner or condition, the adverb, that which is other than something else. Those deeds having otherwise, in other words, they're not evident. They are not able to be hidden. Cannot be concealed is the way it's translated. You got the negative u plus the word dunamai, D-U-N-A-M-A-I. They are not able, literally. To be hidden is the aorist passive infinitive, the complementary infinitive of krupto, which completes the thought of dunamai, K-R-U-P-T-O. And this means that which is hidden, that which is concealed, that which is not evident, that which is covered up. So here we're going to see in this, you're going to have four different types of potential pastor candidates. And by extension, application, you have four different types of believers out there. This can apply at some level to believers as well. So point one, following his personal aside to Timothy, Paul now returns to the issue of ordination and the mistake of laying hands on people, that should be on people, not to people, without due consideration. And as we've pointed out, we've become much more cautious about this. You have to be. We live in the last days. I don't think as a believer you can afford to be undiscerning. You've got to keep your guard up at some level. So too, in order to drive home his point about being cautious when it comes to the matter of ordination of elders, which is also good advice in many realms. Caution is a good way to go in life. Be prudent. You know, maintain, keep your guard up a little bit. Don't be too quick to just lay hands on stuff. Don't be too quick to lay hands on people. We, on the one hand, we recognize positive volition is a rare commodity in the last days and becoming rarer. And so on the one hand, we want to encourage believers. If somebody shows up for Bible class, all that, but we don't want to be the fundies. Glad hand. Oh, glad you're here, brother. You must be positive you showed up. No. How many people have showed up that are not positive ultimately and will manifest that given a certain length of time, whether it's weeks, months, years? Some people, they come in, they vibrate through the whole class, and then they leave, and you never see them again. Okay, well, this wasn't what they were looking for. Other people, they come, they'll stick for months. I've had people stick for 2, 3, 4, 5 years and then ultimately peel off and go their own way. How are you going to know? You got to be cautious. You need to be prudent. Don't be too quick to just assume everybody's what, because some people are good at flying false colors, and you shouldn't do that. So Paul cites four distinct cases here for consideration. Three, while these verses deal specifically with the ordination of elders, they would also have application to other areas of life in the local church. Four, this passage simply shouts the fact that those in positions of leadership are required to use due diligence and exercise discernment with respect to all that come before them for ordination. This is, again, one of the things that I saw completely abused and neglected in the fundamentalist realm. If you just had zeal and you were a Southern Baptist in Oklahoma, that's all you needed. And for those of you who've lived in Oklahoma or have visited there and seen them, some of you might not have seen them if you visited there, but there's a particular group of hardcore legalistic Baptists. And they go out on the corner, and they have zeal. And they preach. They preach loud. And they yell at people as they're going by. And this is their witness for God. Well, and these are the guys they're wanting to train for the ministry, so they send them out to the corner to scream at people. And this is their ordination. You laugh, I know, it sounds weird, but that's the way they did it. And those groups are out there. All you had to have was zeal. I mean, and they'd get out there and they were illiterate and they couldn't put 10 words together, and you know. Good grief. No, that's not how we're going to ordain people. So again, this passage again shouts about the need for investigation, discernment, thought. Be careful, Timothy, with respect to this. 5, discernment is defined by Webster as the act or faculty of discerning. Now, one of the things they teach you in school is don't define a word with itself. But Webster did it in this case. Which means to perceive something so as to lay hold of it with understanding, especially that which is hidden or obscure. Again, this gets to looking beyond just the pale of what you see, what you hear. It goes beyond the pale of human experience in that regard, that you are to look at things, to think about them, to discern what's really going on, that everything is not as it seems on the surface. And people that judge on the surface, what did Jesus caution about? You people judge according to appearance. And that gets you into all kinds of trouble. That is inappropriate judgment according to Jesus. So 6, it is the ability to see beyond the obvious, to recognize or identify something as separate and distinct, to differentiate, to discriminate. Now see, at our time in history, point 7, if a man was someone of discrimination, or rather at one time in history, this was considered a word you wanted to be. You wanted to be a discriminating person. This was an indication of his nobility, an indication of his wisdom, an indication he was to be honored and respected. Nowadays, you hear the word discrimination, what do you immediately think? Racism. They've tied it to a word that has nothing to do with racism, in fact. And the fact is, these people are no longer discriminating out there. Everything is just treated as the same. You see it in their, you know, in their feel-good, touchy-feely, feel-good thing. Oh, you just show up and compete. You're a winner. That's not very discriminating. You're not a winner just by showing up. You got to actually win to win, last time I checked. So, again, if somebody was a man of discrimination, this was a good thing. Yeah, and I think they used to have ads, and I can't, some of them are eluding me now, but I've seen too much TV, you know, for the man of discrimination. And I don't know if they were advertising liquor or whatever it was at that time, for the discriminating person, maybe the cigarettes. And of course, they all taste the same, I figure, but I don't know. So, again, this was a good thing, and it is a good thing in the Bible. So, 8, discernment meant that a man could see clearly between two things. He could discriminate between what was right and wrong, what was good or bad, what was of less importance and what was critical, or what was true or what was false. 9, however, our culture has effectively disparaged this virtue, and discrimination may quickly result in a lawsuit. You discriminated against me. So you got this physically demanding job. You've got to be able to lift 80 pounds, and you don't hire the woman because she can't. Well, that's discrimination, see? In our culture, but that's just good sense in the biblical and physical realm, not to hire someone who couldn't do the job. So it is politically incorrect even to use the term discrimination. They don't like the idea of discrimination at all. But this is a word that's been maligned and misused and now misrepresented by the cosmos to the point where, for some believers, it's viewed as a bad virtue. And it's critical to the Christian life. It's absolutely critical. 10, there can be little doubt that this malaise has infiltrated the church, and believers do not seem to be able to discriminate in matters of critical importance. 11, the comments in these two verses demonstrate Paul's keen insight into human nature and the types of people that would come to the leadership for ordination. Some people have greater insight into human nature than other people do. Some people are able to see things at a level that other people aren't. That's unfortunate, but it's true. And one of the things about discernment we're going to see, because that, and I didn't put it at the end of chapter 5, but I ran out of space on the notes, and rather than use another whole page, I just put it at the beginning of chapter 6. So the doctrine of discernment will be coming up. We will get to that this week. I sent out the corrected copy, so you, those of you who are printing your notes should have it, and we have it ready for those who need it. So some people have insight into what's going on. Other people, they tend to put their head in the ground. They tend to close their eyes. They tend to look the other way. They don't necessarily want to know about all the hard issues. Some people aren't comfortable with dealing with that. Well, as a believer, you better get comfortable dealing with difficult stuff. Because the Christian way of life isn't all just, I'm saved and I'm coasting into heaven on my skateboard. It doesn't work that way. Here Paul has keen insight, which he demonstrates. 12, in fact, these four types of believers may be understood in somewhat of a general sense to denote the various classes of believers that one might find in any local church. 13, Paul uses the plural of the indefinite adjective, tis, to denote the fact that these are not merely individuals, but categories of believers. Certain ones, a group of people. This isn't just an isolated guy. These are types of people to which Timothy will be exposed. 14, the first statement is general and may be considered axiomatic. That which is something which is generally accepted among believers. An axiom is something that's recognized as generally true by most people. The sun will rise tomorrow. That's an axiomatic statement, and most people recognize it's going to rise tomorrow. That's the way it is. 15, the Greek term hamartia, sin, denotes that which is a departure from either human or divine standards of righteousness, that which misses the mark of righteousness. 16, this cannot be understood to refer to sins in general, since every believer sins every day in some area of his or her life. So Paul is not here just talking about what we call incidental sinning. You sin every day. Every believer does. So how are we to discern? Now this gets into the matters of the ordination committee. How is an ordination committee to discern the positive volition of a candidate when they look at his life? Because they're going to know sins. They're going to see sins. Unless the guy's perfect, he's going to have had sins. And how are they going to determine, well, is this guy worthy to be in the ministry? All of them that are going to come before him are going to be sinners. At some level or another, they're going to go down those 15, I would assume they're going to go down those 15 lists of qualifications for pastors there in the first seven verses of Timothy, and they're going to have to grade these guys. Okay, he's strong in this area. So again, you have like 15 items you're grading. Well, let's just say for the sake of purpose here, say you have five. He gets an A here, a B here. Let's say he gets a D here. He's not strong in that one. Gets an A or a B. Well, what's his grade point? Would he meet the level of acceptability that we would put into the ministry? Or are we going to demand that he meets all these qualifications all the time? Nobody, you're never going to put anybody in the ministry. There would be no local churches if you do that. That's not going to happen. But let's say this was kind of, you do this, and so, you know, the old system where you got the D, I think you got 4, 3, 2, 1, yeah. 4 and 3, and then you add them all up, and then you divide it, and you get a grade point average. What is a level of acceptability? I wouldn't want to shoot for the least common denominator. Well, okay, anybody that has a 1.1 we'll put into the ministry. You know, you're going to want to be more discriminating than that, I think. You're going to say, okay, look, and so you might tell a candidate at any point. You have three options now. This is something I've been blessed with and figured out in the last few months. This is new in my thinking in that regard. You have three options. You have yes, no, and maybe. You have yes, no, or put them on hold. Maybe we want to look at you a little while longer. We're not saying yes, we're not saying no. Now, anytime you have this yes, no, or hold situation, the goal of all of this, if you understand, the Greek term dokimazo, means to test something for the purpose of approving it. The goal is approval. So the idea is, okay, you want to be in the ministry. You've expressed this desire. Okay, you've got the academics now. We can test you there. You pass that. Let's say his academics are okay, and he can exegete, and his systematics okay, his theology's all right. You've checked all that out. And then you're going down through these things. Let's say he gets a D in the ability to public, you know, that verse there, the one little deal, able to teach. Let's say that's where he's weak. Let's say he couldn't hold people's interest for 5 seconds. Let's say he's like, you remember the guy in Ferris Bueller? Bueller, Bueller. And the guy that taught, you know, Ben Stein, I like him. But I mean, he plays these parts where he's just monotone. And he's just boring as all get out. And if you had to set under that for 30 minutes, well, you'd be pulling your hair out. Let's say you told the guy, yes, we want to ordain you, but we want you to work on your public speaking skills. We want you to bring this up. Or pick some other area. You got a bad witness on the outside. It's a known fact that you're in debt and you don't pay your bills on time. But we don't want to disqualify you for that. We want to improve you. And so maybe the ordaining council would work with that candidate and say, here's how you can improve here. And this is where the hands-on leadership of a local church can really help believers if they're willing to be helped. Now, if he goes storming out of the meeting, says, you didn't ordain me, to hell with you, and then that's it. Well, okay, fine. Then the leadership's off the hook. He demonstrated a big violation of the one of the mental attitude qualities he's supposed to have, which is sober-mindedness. He doesn't run with his emotions. He doesn't fly off the handle and do that kind of stuff. Well, if he flies out of there, well, that demonstrates. Well, you know, he's kind of disqualified himself. We didn't disqualify. He disqualified himself. But the goal would be, okay, all right, we want you to work on your public speaking skills. How would you help him in that? How would you help him? Maybe you'd have to sit down with him and tell him how to have a budget, how to live within your means, how to quit. Okay, here's your problem. You're pursuing the details of life too much. When you get into the ministry, you can't be doing that. You're not going to be able to lead a congregation if you're all about the details and all about the money. Because what you're going to find out in the ministry is if you're all about the money, you're in the wrong line of work anyway. Because that's not what it's all about. If you got to be all about believers and getting them to maturity and helping them to excel at the Bema Seat. You're here, as Jesus was, to, although he was poor, yet making many rich. And that's Paul was. And that's what you're here for, as a communicator. Okay, so you've got this problem with the details. All right, we need to work on this, and we want to help you. We're not just trying to write you off, but we see this big glaring problem that we got to deal with. And so you would try to help him. But again, the goal would be, in my thinking, to approve the guy. He's got the zeal. He's done the academics. Okay, we need to work on this and this. So again, if he were discussing sins in general, let's say he gets, what we got here, 7, 14, 1, 15 divided by 5. He's got a strong B. Now, I'd put that guy in the ministry. Even if he had an area of weakness here, now, I'd still want to work with him on it. I'd still talk to him about it and say, hey, you got to work on this. You can't do this. You're going to get out there, and you're going to find out that if it's the last day, say, as it is now, and you really want to lead positive believers, you're not just wanting a group, any old group. You want really positive people. That's what you're shooting for. That you want a group that really wants to excel at the Bema Seat. Okay, you need to work on this, but you got a strong B. Okay. All right, I'm okay with that. You're weak here, and you need to be aware of this and need to work on it in the future, but yeah, okay, we'll lay hands on you. Assuming that he had to lay hands on him at that time. So 18, what Paul is, what he is referring to are specific sins that are of such a nature or magnitude that they would disqualify an individual even for consideration for the ministry. We're talking about, he comes to you, and we already know he's a womanizer. We know he's in debt up to his ears. We know that he doesn't pay his bills on time. We know that he's partying every night. We know that he does all these things. That he's got this reputation that precedes him. That he's all about the details and the money. Well, that guy, you don't have to consider him very long before you're going to say, no. No, we couldn't ordain you in good conscience. We have to have a clear conscience before God. So again, if he came to you and you knew all this about him, he was a womanizer, you know, on and on and on, all these things, didn't pay his bills. He was a new convert on top of that he had an arrogance grid that just screamed at you when it walked into the room. I wouldn't ordain that kind of a person, and I don't think Timothy would. So 19, these axiomatic statements are designed to draw attention to the very specific issue of discernment and due diligence regarding the ordination of pastor teachers. 20, in that regard, Timothy must remember that there are two distinct categories of sin, the open and the obvious, and the hidden or undiscerned sins. 21, that is the meaning of the term prodelos, which means that which is quite obvious, clear, evident, or well known. 22, these flagrant violations, and I would assume by saying violations, but he would have a reputation for these things, that these weren't just isolated sins that he did, or it wasn't just sin in one area, that it was a complex of things that you knew about it. And you look back in 1 Timothy 3 there, and you look at these words, temperate. What does that mean? That he's a mild disposition, that he doesn't quickly fly off the handle, that he's got his emotions under control. Prudent, that he thinks through things, that he's got a level head, that he isn't quickly rattled by anything, that he has this decorum and demeanor, respectable in the way he dresses, the way he conducts himself, and all of that. Hospitable, that he's able to be a blessing to other believers, that he's not all about what he can get out of it, that he likes to associate with other believers, and that he's willing to spend his time in his home and whatever else is necessary in order to appropriately entertain other believers. Able to teach, not addicted to wine or pugnacious, out of which, you know, the whole concept. And again, the longer I studied this, the more I realize, or I think, that the pugnacious, the fighting, and the uncontentious, that's one of them. Pugnacious is verbal brawling. You want to settle things with your fists. You get violently angry. Okay, you know this guy has got this problem. He's got an anger streak that he will not deal with, that just wrecks him. And out of that comes, you know, verbal brawling and physical brawling. All he wants to do is argue. That's not the kind of person you want in the ministry. It's not about arguing people into the truth. You've got to pray them into the truth, teach them into the truth. It's not about arguing them into the truth. That's all you can do as a pastor. 1 Timothy or 2 Timothy 2 is very clear on that. So, again, these flagrant violations, if he had these big issues that you know about, and I would say, again, it would probably be a complex of things. It wouldn't just be an isolated deal. I would think that this is the type of guy you're talking about. Well, point 23, the sins seem to be personified here as heralds, which move ahead of the person in question, announce his coming, and trumpet his guilt in advance. 24, while many interpreters have suggested that the judgment refers to the judgment of God, i.e. divine discipline in phase 2, or his final judgment, such is not the case. 25, the judgment in view is the judgment that those in positions of leadership, like Timothy, would have to render on any potential candidate. So they're going to have to make the judgment. Who's making the judgment here? Well, the ordaining council in this regard. 26, what Paul is setting forth here with the first category are the types of believers that would actually require no serious investigation. They are already disqualified. Anyone could see it, and there is actually no further need for discernment or judgment. Again, I would think this guy, to be that kind of a guy, you would have to have a complex of sins that followed you, or of which people were keenly aware. That you were a hothead, you didn't pay your bills, you say you're a new believer. That's also further on down in that list, if he's a new believer. And so it manifests an arrogance trend. And this is one of the things that every pastor has to fight, is that no matter what you know, no matter what you've learned in terms of doctrine, how did you learn it? Grace, as near as I can tell. I don't think it was anything specifically in me that God provides insight because I'm such a great believer. I think he does it for anyone who's positive. And all believers have to keep that before themselves. Where'd you learn all the doctrine you have? From some pastor who did his job right. That's where you learned it, to the extent that you have it. And so that's no reflection on you and how great you are, any more than it's a reflection on any pastor. God, the Holy Spirit's the teacher of doctrine, near as I remember. I mean, obviously, he uses the physical teacher. So, again, here, these people are disqualified. Anyone can see it. There's no need. 27, in this case, even the most inexperienced and undiscerning leader would have no excuse for not noticing these departures from righteousness. 28, the second category of men that might come to the elders for ordination are those whose sins may not be so obvious on the surface. So we have two categories of sins. Again, the seen, the obvious, the unseen, the subtle. Now, as somebody on an ordaining council, you better be able to discern both of them, if that's your niche. 29, these types of people operate under a cloak of secrecy. We call it guile. Pretending, we call that hypocrisy, to be something they are not in order to advance themselves. Matthew 23:28. This is exactly, I mean, again, if this does not scream to you the need for discernment, I don't know what passage would. Because everybody is not what they appear to be on the surface. Matthew 23:28. Here, as he talks about the scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, like whitewashed tombs on the outside, you appear beautiful. You look clean on the surface. You know, and there are some believers that are like that. They make sure they're what I like to call the nicest little troublemaker on the block. On the surface, oh, they look squeaky clean. They never did anything. But behind the scenes, they've manipulated, they've cajoled, they've done all these things that people are not aware of in order to advance their cause and get their way. And there are some people that are just downright sneaky about it. And you better be aware of this. That some believers are just downright sneaky. Other believers, they're right in your face and you can see what's going on. Some believers, they're dissimulators. They want to make themselves look good all the while out here advancing some hidden agenda. That is what the danger that Paul is warning Timothy about here, that you've got to check this type. Even so, you too outwardly appear righteous to men, but inwardly you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. And again, the pretending part, secrecy, advancing a hidden agenda. Now, these are not things that are to be indicative of positive believers. This is not a part of advancing God's plan. Well, 30, however, as the leadership begins an in-depth and rigorous examination of this type of believer, the discernment of the ordaining board will bring his sins to light. Mark 12:15. So this believer screams for the need for investigation, this type of person, this type of pastor candidate. This just says, you better be careful. Mark 12:15. Shall we pay? They were talking to him. They're trying to test Jesus. And see, that's something. Some people will try to test you. They'll just try to see if they can get something over on you. And that's the nature of some people. Well, don't be that kind of person, obviously. They're trying to trap Jesus. They're trying to trip him up here. Shall we pay or shall we not pay? Dealing with the issue of poll tax to Caesar. But he, knowing their hypocrisy. How did he know their hypocrisy? He could read them. Right in front of him, he could read them. He knew them. He saw right through them. And there are believers that are like that. They're very astute when it comes to other people. They're not easily and readily taken in. They have trained themselves by persistent application to be discerning. In fact, as we're going to get into the doctrine of discernment, we're going to see that that's an indictment of a lot of believers. They are not discerning. They don't want to look at the hard issues and admit that people are not what they always appear to be. And so in Hebrews, they're going to be chided because they were undiscerning. Why were they undiscerning? They didn't practice discernment. And if you don't practice discernment, you're never going to see anything. So Mark 12:15 here, knowing their hypocrisy, how did he know it? Was this a function of his deity? I don't think so in this case. Now, he got, part of his niche was, he could read men. He knew what was in men's hearts, so. He understood mankind, and he knew what he was dealing with. And these people were coming to him, appearing on the surface, oh, we're just here to ask a question. And all they were trying to do was trip him up and trap him and make things, you know. But, oh, no, hey, we're just nice. No, that wasn't what they were about at all. Why are you testing me? Bring me a denarius to look at. So 31, all believers should recognize there are some people that may look good on the surface. However, they simply do things to be recognized by others. Some people, why do they apply? So everybody will think they're nice. It's not coming necessarily from doctrine in the soul or being in fellowship and all those things, right men motivations and all of that, right mental attitude. It's coming so they'll look good for people. So people will pat them on the back and say, you're a good guy. You're a good girl. We love you. Why? Because you do things for people. Matthew 6, 5 and 16 deals with that issue. And when you pray, you are not to be as the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners in order to be seen by men. No other purpose. They're praying so men will see them and think they're great. Also, verse 16, same chapter. And whenever you fast, do not put on a gloomy face as the hypocrites do. They neglect their appearance in order to be seen fasting by men. So men will say, oh, look how spiritual they are. They're just doing it for approbation lust. Jesus said, they got their reward in full. They're not going to get any reward from God for all that. And they're going to be believers with a lot of stuff that's just going to burn up at the bema seat. Activity that was done out of human motivations, trying to look good, trying to impress people. Apply because it comes from the doctrine in your soul. That's what we shoot for. The goal of our instruction is love from a pure heart. Some people do it here in this case. They're trying to buy an office. For instance, in Acts 8, 18 and 19, we see it. This would be the kind of person that's trying to worm his way into the ministry. And maybe they wine and dine the ordaining council. Hey, I'm going to take you guys out, you know, to Ruth's Chris. Oh, that's nice. You've never done it before. Why now all of a sudden? Oh, no reason. Now, if you were on the ordaining council, would your guard not go whoop? What? When people come to you all of a sudden, oh, I love you. You're my friend. You've never spoken to me. What's up? Why all the sudden change? Why the sudden change of heart? What's up here? That's where your discernment better shoot up very quick. And you better be willing to ask some hard questions. So you just want to take the ordaining council out. No motivation here. And, oh, sure, yeah, order whatever you want. Well, maybe the guy's got an agenda, just like they had here in Acts 8. 18 and 19. And when Simon saw the Spirit was bestowed through the laying on of the apostles' hands, he offered them money and said, give me this authority to me as well, so that everyone on whom I lay hands may receive the Holy Spirit. Peter said, well, they've toned it down for the New American Standard. You and your money can go to hell. That's what he said. You and your money can perish together. People say, well, Peter wouldn't have said that. That wasn't very loving. Well, that's exactly the attitude you've got to have. So again, all believers should recognize some may look good on the surface. Some do it to simply be recognized. Some do it to try to buy an office or advance themselves. Or some simply fool the undiscerning so they can get their way. Some people just have a hidden agenda. They want their way, and they're willing to do whatever they got to do to get it. And if that means looking good before people, we can do that for a while. So 32, this is the sense of the verb epakoleutheo, follow after, which means that his sins are exposed at the time he's being considered for ordination. And again, I don't think isolated individual sins is what we're talking about here. I think when they go to investigate this guy, they find this complex of things about him. Maybe his doctrinal grid isn't what he, you know, appeared to be. Maybe his moral life isn't what it appeared to be. Maybe he was carrying on behind the people's back. So the ordaining council has to look into these things and ask the hard questions. And the candidate that's not forthcoming. Pretend you're on the ordaining council. Now, I know all of you are not deacons or pastors, but pretend you're on an ordaining council. There's three or four of you, let's say. And you have to make a decision about a man coming before you. And you do some investigation. What kind of hard questions are you going to ask him? With the recognition, of course, that they need to be, you know, biblically appropriate questions and all that as well. Constitutionally appropriate questions. You can't just throw everything out and say, well, I'm going to ask him about something that's completely unrelated. Well, that doesn't serve any purpose. How willing are you to investigate this? What if it's somebody who you personally know and is a friend of yours? And they come to you and your spiritual discernment is telling you, you know, this guy's not qualified. But then you got that problem with the friendship that you would have to overrule or overcome. And look at him with a very critical eye. So again, these types of people, when people start to investigate, their complex has shown up. That they're not what they appear to be on the surface. So 33, the overt and obvious sins are readily seen and easily condemned. Anybody can do that. You don't have to be very discerning at all to do that. The less obvious or hidden sins might take some serious investigation to uncover. And we're going to have to stop there today. Our time is up. We will wrap this up. You'll need the doctrine of discernment this week, and I will attempt to get out at least, hopefully, the first 18 or 20 pages of chapter 6 as well. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit enlighten us and continue to guide us in the truth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.